Good morning, Suzanne. Today is 31st of May 2013, and we are here to interview Suzanne Ullman. And generally how we start is we ask you what your name was at birth and where you were born and when you were born.
I was born in Budapest in 1935, 8th of December, and my name, Hungarian name, is Ullman Zsuzsanna Luisa. Suzanne Louise Ullman.
And are you an only child or...?
No, I have twin brothers who are 2 years younger than myself and a twin brother and sister who were actually born in London during the war.
So are you the eldest?
I'm the eldest.
Right, and would you like to tell us a wee bit of where you grew up in Budapest? Was it a typical Jewish community?
My father went on business to London in 39, and my mother went to visit him, and she was unable to return. She went to visit him, I think, in 1940, during the war, had already broken out. And we got stranded in Hungary, and I was, four, and my brothers were two. And my parents had been living with our paternal grandmother, in a flat. We just stayed there with a nanny.
Was your father still in London? Or was he?
Yes, throughout the war, my parents were in London, so we were separated for 7.5 years. And the younger twins, the boy and a girl, they're born in England during the Blitz. I don't know when the Blitz was. In 1942, they were born.
So were you able to kind of keep in contact?
Well, I have just finished translating my grandmother's letters from 1940 to 1942, and then correspondence stopped. And the letters went via Geneva, the Red Cross, Thomas Cook. Some she sent to New York, and they were posted on from New York to London. Others she sent to a relative in Los Angeles. And as not all the letters arrived, she started numbering them after a while so that she knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, there some, didn't arrive at all. So then correspondence stopped in 1942.
It must have been very traumatic for you, though, at the age of four.
Well, a child accepts whatever comes, but she says that I talked about my parents every day. And in one of the letters, she quotes me as saying, "I'm really embittered that they're not here, not coming here back. Why aren't they coming back?" And she says, "Because the war's on." I say, "Well, they could take an aeroplane, or they could walk, or..." I'm suggesting ways. So I missed them terribly.
So what age did you start school in Budapest?
In Hungary, I went to a nursery school for a while. I loved school, but there wasn't much money. Because my parents weren't there to earn the money. I went to primary school later on, but the war disrupted
education. And so was your grandmother working?
No, my maternal grandmother was a rather helpless figure. She was actually German, and she never learned, in 45 years in Hungary, she never learned to speak Hungarian.
Right.
But it was my maternal grandmother who really did all the work, and she lived elsewhere. And my mother came from a poor family and my father from a rich family. So there was a great tension. They didn't want the marriage to take place. So my father courted my mother for 6 years. And it wasn't until his father died that he was able to marry.
How did they meet? If they were
They met in a sort of Academy of Economics. It was called Kereskedelmi Akadémia because there was something called the numerus clausus, which I understand was only a certain 20% of Jews were able to go to university. There was a restriction on Jewish attendance, so they couldn't go to universities. So they went to this commercial academy and they met there.
Did you have a Jewish life?
Well, I remember my maternal grandmother we called Little Grandma because she was very small. And when they introduced me to my grandmothers, they said, this is your grandmama. I said, she isn't grand, she's small. So she became known as Little Grandma forever. The other one was called Old Grandma, and she was older, but she was old in her ways. Mm-hmm. And I remember every morning she would read her prayer book, and she would sort of bless us, but, you know, we didn't really have any anything else.
So you were quite young, obviously, living there and living, obviously, with a generation that were much older. So did you make friends at the nursery school?
Well, I was only allowed to go there for a very 6 weeks initially.
Right.
I get this from the letters I've just found and translated. And I just loved being there with the children. Otherwise, no. The nannies would take us to the park if it pleased them. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we were quite ill-treated, according to my maternal grandmother, especially later on, you know, when the Nazis came in, things got very bad. So when food was short, you know, we weren't given enough to eat because they were feeding their sweethearts and own children with the food available. No, or just had my brothers. So we fought a lot. Because we have, we're very restricted in space.
Do you remember much of your life, or do you find that when you're reading the letters that reminds you?
No, I remember it vividly because the things that happened impressed themselves on your consciousness because they were so unusual. I remember the various nannies and the way they treated us. But I learned things from the letters which were not clear to me, the fact that they brought their lovers up and, you know, had orgies in my parents' bedroom, for instance. I was conscious of people being there, but of course I didn't know what. So I was protected by my ignorance from a lot of harm that an older child.
And I would imagine it would be difficult for your grandmother to complain because of the situation.
Well, it was extremely difficult because Little Grandma lived elsewhere. She didn't have influence at home. She had the brains and she knew what was going on. Old Grandma, she didn't know what was going on, but she had the money. And when she complained of what was going on, Old Grandma just raised the salaries of the personnel. So it was a very abnormal situation.
Did Old Grandma live with you? Or was
We lived. When my parents got married, they lived with Old Grandma. She was quite naive. She loved us, but I mean, in one of the letters, for instance, she says to Little Grandma, if my son wouldn't have got married, he wouldn't have had these children and I wouldn't have all this bother. Oh. But then she says to my parents, she really does love the children. So, you know, these things came out, but she wasn't quite up to the situation.
Did you see soldiers?
Well, you see, what we had in Hungary was the Arrow Cross. They were a special sort of branch of the gendarmerie, and they were Nazis. But the regime was under Horthy, who was in charge of the land. And I remember distinctly when the Germans came in to Budapest, because what happened was the Germans occupied the country, but from the periphery, and it was like a sort of pincer action. So they collected the Jews and off to Auschwitz or wherever, concentration camp, from the provinces, and Budapest was the last place. And that was 19th of March, 1944, and I remember climbing up on a chair, looking out of the window, and seeing them march sort of 20 abreast up the street. We lived on a Andrássy út, which was one of the prominent streets. And it was then that things really became bad.
Were you taken to the ghetto?
Well, we lived in a very important corner house, Andrássy út ghetto number 2, and certain houses were allocated to the Jews, and they were starred, and a big star, yellow star on a black background was stuck on the door, and Jews had to live in these starred houses, so it was like a ghetto house, and the Christians who lived there had the option of either moving out or staying there. And luckily, our house was a start house, so we didn't have to move out. But we had a flat on the fourth floor with four rooms, old grandma had a room, my parents had a bedroom, there was a big dining room and a small nursery for the three of us, plus the nursemaid. So we were quite squashed. And in the end, there were 18 people living there because we tried to get our own relatives to move in. Mm-hmm. And one family came in, and then other Jewish families came in. And that happened to us, but it didn't last long because the Nazis rather liked this lovely big building, which was in a prominent position. And then they ousted us, and we had to move to a very small flat. Well, we had just two rooms, quite a different part of the town.
What happened to the families that had moved in? Did you all go together, or?
I had no idea. We all scattered different places.
Right.
Because the flat we went into was on the second floor of a very tall building, I don't know, six stories high or something. And it was very dark because the rooms opened out onto the courtyard. And there's no light at all. We had to have electric light all the time. And there was another two people living in there, a man and a woman. And
was that in the ghetto, in the actual ghetto?
Well, it wasn't really a ghetto as such. There was a ghetto, but these were just start houses, mm-hmm. individual houses with mm-hmm. stars on them, and Jews were allocated. There was a ghetto near the synagogue called Dohain Utsai Ghetto, but we weren't there.
And would you be able to go out during the day?
As I learned from the letters, time was restricted. We had an hour in the afternoon. That was from March 44. That's when the Nazis were in Budapest. And then food became very short, and Jews were only allowed out 1 hour in the afternoon to do their shopping. But there was nothing to shop. Mm-hmm. And also, Jews were given special food cards with huge yellow star. It was bright yellow, garish yellow. And by the time afternoon came, there's nothing. So it was desperate.
And it would be horrible if any of you or your siblings became unwell.
I remember that this was before 44, 42. I was ill for a whole year, so I missed school. Because in the autumn, I got yellow jaundice. And then I got scarlet fever, and that was an infectious disease. So I was put into isolation hospital. And I remember little grandma coming to visit and just seeing her through the window. And that was fun for me because there were children there and I was jumping up and down in the bed. And I had pneumonia three times that winter. But it was difficult for Jews to get an ambulance. And somehow they took me. I got landed in hospital, and I remember being fed through the veins. I couldn't eat, you know, I was really ill. And I got injections. I remember that distinctly. And so I was ill the whole year, and the school mistress sometimes came to give me lessons in bed. And I remember the one, she used to scold me because I was jumping up and down. And she says, you know, you're behaving like a monkey. And then she said, just remember, it's only people we love that we want to correct.
And she would be non-Jewish?
I suppose mm-hmm. so.
So were you able to continue going to school after the Nazis came in as well?
No, and then all personnel had to be dismissed. Jews weren't allowed to have any servants or, mm-hmm. you know, cooks or whatever, because it was customary. I mean, we had somebody looking after us. Old grandma couldn't look after us. But when the starred buildings came in, the little grandma, as it were, abandoned her husband and came and lived with us to look after us, because that was her great aim in life, was to save us for our parents, unite us with our parents. And so then we had her and that. But they all had to go. Everybody had to go.
It must have been absolutely awful for your parents being, you know,
well,
in this
yes.
looking
and by that time, no letters. Mm-hmm. And I remember my grandmother burning all anything from England, because that was... And oh yes, they started taking everything away. Every day there was a new regulation, complicated regulations. They'd ring some bell and we'd go out onto the courtyard, you know, these houses were built around courtyards, and there'd be some proclamation. All Jews had to give in the radios. On pain of death, you weren't allowed to, even before then, listen to foreign stations. I mean, it was on pain of, you know, any excuse that take you away. And you had to hand in all your jewelry, anything valuable, declare it. And lots of papers to fill in. I mean, I wasn't aware of all the paperwork. I just remember queuing up to hand in our goods. It was opposite the opera house in Budapest, I remember. But every day there was more and more restrictions. In the end, the state owned everything that you had. And when we had to move from our original building to the second Stadthaus, the problem was, what do you do with your furniture? Mm-hmm. You had to clear out within 24 hours. The new place, you know, you couldn't house everything. And you weren't allowed to leave it on the street. You had to look after it because it wasn't yours. It now belonged to the state. So you were between a rock and a hard place. And all the restrictions were so complicated that a lawyer couldn't understand it. And they deliberately did that to sort of trick you and, you know, any excuse to take you away. And I learned these from the letters because, of course, I remember the move and this and that, but I didn't know all the background, the paperwork. I'm learning that now, that I've discovered a 50-page account of what happened that my 100-year-old aunt gave me last time I visited her in Los Angeles.
It's quite wonderful that actually somebody's taken the time, and I think that's very important, because otherwise people don't have an understanding.
Yes.
At all.
So I'm learning the background from the adult's point of view. I remember in our first Stadthaus, and there was such confusion and so many people, and you know, one kitchen, everybody trying to cook there. And of course, the children, you know, we were just cramped in with that. And I lost my temper for the first time in my life. My grandmother was cross with me because I didn't obey her, you know, go to have a meal, sit down. I was playing around. And she took one of my toys, and poor grandma, she must have been so harassed, and she broke one of these toys, a little plate. And I was so appalled by this that I lost it. And I started smashing my own most precious toys. And I was crying and weeping, and I was hysterical. And one of the people who lived in our flat, she just took me, locked me up in the bathroom and calmed me down. But I remember crying. I was absolutely hysterical. I don't think I ever lost my temper. It so frightened me, the whole experience of losing it. I think I was 7 at the time.
You were about 7 at that time. If you weren't able to go outside and you weren't really able to go to school, and you were there till 11, I was wondering how you would actually spend your time.
In Hungary, you mean? Mm-hmm. When we were in confinement, a large part was fighting with my brothers or trying to get away from them, which I couldn't. And I tried to do my sewing. I liked sewing and knitting. And I would want to go into the dining room, which I wasn't always allowed to do by these nannies. And my little grandma came, she, you know, made things better for me because she said, you know, she wants peace. She's very nervous. And the boys make her nervous. And I read. I loved reading. And of course we had, in 44, the bombs came, you know, the Allies were bombing us, so we had the Nazis, but we had another war from above. So about 3 or 4 times a day or night, we might have to go into the cellar when the sirens started, you know, hooting. And I remember being given a torch in order to go down into the cellar. And I made good use of this because I used it to read under my eiderdowns. But you had to be very careful because the room was shared by the nanny and my two brothers. And I had to insulate myself under the eiderdowns so the light didn't seep out. And I just adored reading. I was just avid.
I think it would be a very good form of escapism, actually.
Pardon?
It would be a good form of escapism.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I learned to read by the age of four. We could all read. I don't know, we always asked what the inscriptions were, and we just sort of almost taught ourselves. So I read and I did little work, handwork, learned poems.
And your brothers also learned to read themselves
yes,
as well?
Yes, yes.
Where did you get the books from?
Well, we had books from before. I mean, the things didn't really become bad till the Nazis were actually in 44. You see, while in London, my parents, I've got one letter from my parents writing back. And they, in 1940, the Blitz is on. And they're saying, you're lucky you don't have a war there. So we didn't actually experience mm-hmm. the war in mm-hmm. Hungary. Till, you know, 44, mm-hmm. when the bombs started flying. Then we had it from every side. We had the Nazis being Jewish, and we had the bombs. So we were going down into the cellar all the time. But before then, it was just gradual. The Arrow Cross were harassing us, always more and more and more. But in Budapest, we were relatively safe till later on. Eichmann then settled in, and his one objective was to eliminate the Jews, whatever. And at the same time, Wallenberg, unbeknown to us, was there negotiating with Eichmann.
What happened to the Germans afterwards?
Well, what happened? Well, we were in this house, the second Stadthaus near the parliament, and then all sorts of rumors were going around all the time. Things were getting worse and worse and worse all the time, and people were taken away. And rumors were going around, and people were trying to escape or pay money to get on a ship. And then rumors were that, you know, you paid your money, you got on the ship to go to America, and then they drowned you, you know, in the ship. So little grandma didn't know what to do. And what eventually happened was that she had a sister who had Christian papers. No, what happened was we went into a protected house. It was a hospital, nominally a hospital. So we all moved into this hospital on one of the large boulevards. And this hospital was actually in the pay of some Nazis. And there's a Nazi guard outside, but inside was a bedlam of Jews. And the adults were on the first two floors, and the children were up on the third and fourth floor. It was absolute bedlam because, you know, there's crammed lots of Jews in, and I suppose they paid for it. And they were on the corridors, and the children were trying to commit suicide, throwing themselves, you know, into the court. It was awful. But we were there for about 6 weeks, I think. And just before Christmas, things were getting worse and worse. And a sister of little grandma's who had some Christian papers, she managed to get in. And one day little grandma said to us, she dressed us all up in our clothes, and she said, someone's going to come at 9 o'clock tonight, and you have to call her mother and just do everything she says, and just go with her. So we just had to say goodbye. It was the 19th of December, I remember. And my brothers and I, this woman came at 9 o'clock at night, and she took us out onto the street, and it was dark. Everybody was running around. It was pre-Christmas, and it was busy, and we hadn't been out, you know, for 6 weeks in the streets. And she said, don't talk, you know, don't say anything, just call her mother. And we got onto a very crammed bus. It was a tram. Mm-hmm. We had trams. And we just followed her. And she took us down to near the Danube. And I remember this house had a big plaque outside, a sort of metal plaque. And all I remember was this cross and something, it said something about Swedish Red Cross. And so she deposited us there and she went away. And it was a sort of nursery. And there were mostly mothers and babies, and we were sort of big children, you know, like eight. I was just nine. 9 and 7 we were. So we didn't have any relatives there, all the other children, and there were about three other children, 12 and 11. So we stayed there, and it was actually very nice because we got food, proper food. We had proper beds. In the hospital, I was sharing a bed with, you know.
Who arranged for you to go into the hospital? I was
wondering. Little grandma's sister with the Christian papers.
She arranged for you to go to the hospital originally?
No. I don't know who arranged the hospital. I think little grandma arranged the hospital. Mm-hmm. Somehow, mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I'll find out when I study the letters better. All I knew is that, no, it was her sister, Terko, who came to the hospital and arranged this transfer with this pseudo-mother to go to this mm-hmm. house. Now, we stayed in that house, and we had Christmas there, I remember. And I even got a Christmas present, little embroidery set, and I still have a little embroidery piece which I did the cross stitch. But I didn't discover what that house was till the 1980s here in Glasgow, when someone handed me a newspaper cutting saying, Suzanne, you may be interested, this is about Hungary. And I read about Wallenberg, and it suddenly clicked, because one of the puzzles was, I remember this plaque on the door with a cross, and I always thought it was the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. And why was it Swedish Red Cross? After all, Red Cross is international, and I never understood that. And suddenly it clicked that it was actually not a Red Cross, it was a white cross of the Swedish flag, because I then looked it up. And it was one of Wallenberg's houses.
Wonderful. That,
mm-hmm. And it was only in the 80s. But when we were in that house, of course the bombs were, this is Christmas, 1944, the Russians are coming in, and the Germans are retreating, and the bombers are flying, so we were going down into the cellar all the time. And eventually we went down into the cellar, and they bombed the house. It fell to pieces, and we lived down there about 6 weeks, something like that. And we had very little to eat.
You lived in the cellar?
Yeah. And the Russians came in, and I don't know whether it was the Germans or the Russians, they poisoned the water supply. They were pushing the Germans across the Danube, so the Germans retreated across the bridges from Pest to Buda. They blew up the bridges so that the Russians couldn't follow them. Of course, we didn't know anything about our grandmothers. They were in the hospital or somewhere. And we were in the cellar during, this was called the Ostrom, which is the, what is it, the siege mm-hmm. of Budapest. And this would be just after Christmas, up to New Year. And then the Russians started arriving. And they, of course, we children, nobody was looking after us. We older children, the mothers were looking after their babies. And I remember my brother Joseph and I going upstairs out into the air, because we had no water, so we were scraping the snow and bringing it down to melt it. There was a little stove. Everybody was trying to, you know, cook on that little stove or melt water or whatever. And I remember they shoved a pot of boiling water, and, you know, my brother got burnt because the water just went over him. And my brother Louis, he was too dispirited. He just lay there on the ground. The basement was actually the basement of a paper factory. So there were shelves, sort of, and we just slept on the shelves or on the floor, and they were just too loose for everybody. So it was pretty awful, and there was nothing to eat except two things I remember, a sack full. They tried to bring, the Germans, they robbed the Wallenberg establishment, which had a lot of food there. They just carried huge carcasses out that he had stored there for the children. And we just had sackfuls of, it was called baby lavash. It was some sort of powdered stuff.
You like made soup. All right, yeah. Like porridge.
Well, it was made of pulse, some sort of peas or something. And you had huge lumps of krumplitzuk, or it was potato sugar. It was a sweet stuff. So mm-hmm. we just ate that. You know, we had bits of this. We had nothing else to eat. And then and the Russians started coming in, and they came down, and they were drunk. I remember seeing fights, knife fights between Russian soldiers down there, and we were just, you know, cowering in the corner. And they were quite primitive, some of them. They came in and they said, "Ura, ura, ura." Ura means watch. They were collecting watches. They had about 20 watches all up this. They were just collecting things. They were quite young chaps. So, you know, all that went on. And then the Germans disappeared and the Russians were in. And what else happened? Well, by January, middle of January, you know, the Germans were out and people started disappearing, you know, the mothers with their children. We had nobody. So they didn't know what to do with us. The cook and a few of the adults from the care home upstairs, they were still there and they just didn't know what to do. So end of January, they wanted to dispose of us. And I don't know why, but they separated me and my brothers. And they took the boys off Lord knows where. And I was taken by Steffi, the cook. She was looking for an orphanage. And I remember tramping through the streets of Budapest in the snow, looking for the orphanage. But we didn't find it, so we went back again into the cellar. And the next day again, eventually we found the National Hungarian Orphanage. But it was for boys. And I was a girl. And she pleaded with the lady there to take me. So I was eventually taken in to the orphanage as the only girl and left there. So by this time I'd lost everybody, my brothers, my grandmothers. And so they took me up into one of the corridors. Of course, the house, they said no windows, everything was sort of wartime. By this time it was beginning of February. And I remember they cut my hair. They didn't cut it all off. They just cut it and washed it. They took all my clothes were, of course, all ridden with lice. I had head lice, I had body lice. So they took all the clothes and burnt it. And they gave me a boy's uniform, you know, of the orphanage. And so I actually had quite a happy time there. We were all 45 of us sleeping in one big bedroom. And we give little nightgowns and we had to say our prayers before going to bed. And well, we were given a minimal amount of food. And the nurse who was looking after us was actually, she told me, Jewish herself. Her husband was taken away. But, you know, she sort of kept that quiet. She got a job there. And when we were going for a walk during the day, she would always go down to the Danube because they'd put up a pontoon bridge for the people coming back from the war. She was always looking for her husband, and she confided in me, who was 9 years old, about her problems. And I don't know whether her name was Edith Nervier, Edith, Nurse Edith, but whether she found her husband, I don't know. But eventually, it really was quite miraculous because we all got together. We didn't know, of course, what happened to our... I didn't know anything about anything. And one day a man appeared, and he was a distant relative of little grandma's, and he must have gone to all the orphanages and hospitals and everywhere. He somehow found me. How? I don't know. And eventually he was in communication, because what happened, little grandma had gone with this person who took us to the orphanage and called us mother, whom we had to call mother. And she was a Christian lady. I don't know what motivated her or whether she got paid, I don't know. But she took little grandma as her mother. Little grandma didn't look Jewish. And little grandma was her mother. She took her across to Buda, upside, to a place called Vermese, which means the field of blood, actually, and stayed with her, and she posed as a mother. And that house where she had a miraculous escape, because the house she was in was bombed, and as the bombs were coming, they didn't know what to do. They ran into the bathroom, and the whole house collapsed except for the bathroom. I mean, it was totally miraculous.
It is.
And then she couldn't get back to Budapest because there were no bridges. Mm-hmm. And the Danube was frozen. And there were big blocks of ice floating. And a lot of people floated across. And some fell into the water. And she thought, I've survived. I'm not going to get drowned. I'll wait till a bridge is put up, something. So that eventually they, you know, put up these pontoon bridges. And so then somehow she turned up at the orphanage. Totally miraculous.
And what happened to your brothers?
Well, when we were going for a walk in the orphanage, myself and all these boys, we used to have to go in crocodiles, two by two, with somebody, a teacher. And there were other groups of children, and I used to go up and say, do you have twin boys with you? You know, I was looking for them on the street as we were met, but I didn't find them. And what happened to them, I discovered later, is the boys were taken, actually, and deposited in a monastery, or at least with monks somewhere. So they didn't know what to do with two little sort of lice-ridden Jewish boys, the monks. They had enough to eat, but they got rid of them. But my brothers say they sat them in the kitchen on stools, and I think they slept on these chairs. Eventually, after a few days, they took them to some care home they found. And the boys, although they were only seven, they remembered the dress of one of the relatives. And then the people from the care home went to this address, and right enough, they found these relatives. So one of the relatives came over, mm-hmm. and made contact with them, and I saw that they were, and this relative only died a few years ago, so, you know, she told me lots of stories. She said she went there, and Louis was, who was seven, was begging for just a tiny crust of dry bread, just bring us something. And she then got some food, but she had to stay there and watch till they ate it, because if she didn't, it would be taken by somebody else, you know. So she just stood there while they were eating whatever she brought. And so eventually little grandma must have made contact, and so they knew where the boys were. This other male relative must have somehow got in touch with little grandma, and little grandma turned up in the orphanage where I was. It must be March by this time. And I remember the first thing she brought was a toothbrush, some food and a toothbrush. And so, you know, we were together. And then the boys were eventually, they came to join me in the orphanage. So we were in the orphanage, and she would come and bring baskets of food whenever she had, because, of course, everything was pretty dire even there. But, you know, we got a bed and we had
roof. And did your other grandmother, did she survive?
Well, we didn't know what, she stayed in the hospital because she was sort of old and mm-hmm. cumbersome, and she had swollen feet. She couldn't move much. So she was left there, and she survived too. And somehow, we just don't know, because she was never mobile, you know, she had these swollen feet, she managed to find her way back to the original start house. And, you know, little grandma must have gone round, you know, looking for her, and she was found too. How she did this journey, we don't know, we could never understand, but we all survived.
Absolutely incredible.
So the Russians are there, you're under a communist regime.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, we were in the orphanage now, and at Whitsun that first year is the first time we went home to our second start house. And little grandma made us a, you know, an ujona, which is a tea. You know, we had cocoa and we have, she made fang, what is that in English? These nut scones.
Pancakes?
Pardon?
Pancakes?
No, they're not pancakes. I forget the names of them. Anyway, she made these things, whole paper. And of course, I disgraced my, that was the second memory I have, which I've never forgotten, is I ate and ate and ate and I couldn't stop eating. And what was left, she put in the larder. But of course, I went into the larder and ate some more and the inevitable happened and I was sick. And I was so ashamed. I've never been sick in my life again after that. And so we spent the weekend there, the Whitsun weekend from the orphanage. We went back to the orphanage and we stayed there till about July. And then there were camps for rehabilitating, you know, destitute children who were starved. And we got to go to one of these camps on the mountain in Buda. And we stayed there for about, till Christmas, for about 3 months. And little grandma would climb the mountain with baskets of food and, you know, whenever she had something. And she and old grandma were living in the second start house mm-hmm. that we had. The first one, you know, that was gone. And somehow quite a lot of the furniture managed to survive too. And so that would be about 45, end of 44, 45. So the Russians are in. So now she made contact with London, mm-hmm. my parents. So we were in contact again. And now was the business, how do we get out? So she went every day and put in petitions here and there. And I suppose our luck was because we were too young to be of use to the communist state. The grandmas were too old. So eventually they let us go. End of 46, she got the papers and we emigrated. So I'm not a refugee, I'm an emigrant. And we even got some of the furniture out. So we were reunited in 1946. So we met our parents for the first time. Well, yeah.
And London. Did the boys have much of a memory of the
No, the boys don't remember as much as I do.
Because, and would they have remembered their parents because they were only
no,
two?
No, they were only two. They didn't remember the parents. And I hardly remember my father. I just remember one or two incidents with my mother, jumping up and down in her bed or, you know, her teaching me how to pray and things like that. But no.
And how was it? How was it when you met them for the first time?
Well, the wonderful thing was that this little grandma of mine was a really remarkable woman. And she always talked about my parents, so much so, showed us pictures that we felt we knew them, told us stories about their childhood, everything. So that they weren't strange and showed us photographs. She says in her letters that I kiss the photographs every day, and, you know. And why aren't they coming back? But I myself, you know, I felt I knew them. Mm-hmm. Because she made it so, I mean, I think back now how clever she was, how mm-hmm. insightful. You know, she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. So, but then I was very disappointed because I was dying to see my brother and sister, John and Eva, the English ones. But they weren't at home. I was desperately disappointed. It wasn't till December that I saw them because, unbeknown to me, they had been evacuated during the war and they were at first in a Jewish nursery in Knutsford near Manchester, in a Jewish nursery. And I was bullying my parents. So in December, they took myself and my two grandmothers, I don't think the boys were there, to Manchester and they spent the night there. And I remember there was an announcement on the news that in this particular nursing home, a fire had broken out and a child had died. And my father went berserk, but it wasn't my brother and sister. So the next day we went there and we went to this nursing home and my father went in with the grandmothers and I was just sitting outside and this little girl comes in and out to go to the loo or something, and she's looks me up and down. And later on, I was introduced to her as my sister. And of course, we couldn't communicate. They were 4 years old, and I was 11. And we had no language in common. So I spent the night there in the nursery with it was December and it was cold. I remember lying in a cot beside my little brother John, and we just sort of held hands in the dark, you know, across the bed. So they stayed there. We went back to London, and, you know, then our life began in in England.
What did your father do during the war?
My father, he first worked in, I think, in a bookshop. He had some Hungarian contacts in London. He was a jeweler by trade. And then he worked for a man called Mr. Wies, who was a jeweler. I think he was a jeweler, anyway. And in an office. And eventually, that's what he did during the war, yes. And after the war, he went into partnership with another Hungarian and opened a shop in Hatton Garden. And my brother Joe eventually carried on. Two of my brothers are in the trade.
Oh, right. And is that jewellery?
Yep. And little grandma in one of her letters says to my parents during the 40s, you know, maybe one day Joseph will, or one of them will carry on. And that's what happened.
So you went to school in London. And you said you
I
must
went
have had
to school in London for a year.
Right, which, as you said, very steep learning curve to...
Well, yes, I couldn't speak. I went first in Golders Green. We lived in... My parents had to buy a new house and move to Golders Green because, you know, the family was going to be enlarged. And I went to the local school in Golders Green. They put me in there. And the first week I arrived, couldn't speak. I had a few words like window and pencil and nothing else. And two of the little girls from the school came and picked me up and walked me to school. And all I knew was that when they said 54, I had to say yes, because I was number 54 in the class.
54?
On the register.
On the register. And during lunchtime, because there were too many children in the school, there were British restaurants, wartime restaurants, and a bunch of us went to the British restaurant, and I remember sitting there crying my eyes out because I didn't know how to use a knife and fork. These little girls were eating with all sorts of strange things like Spam, which I thought was terrible with these jelly bits in it, and custard. I'd never eaten custard, and I didn't know how to use the implements. But anyway, after Christmas, my parents put me into a boarding school, a weekly boarding school in London, in Sheen, to learn English. Mm-hmm. And I'd go home, and I was crying. I said, why'd you put me up? Been waiting all this time, now you've sent me away again, you know. I was devastated. But anyway, I went to school there and I just learned English. I just had to. If I didn't know what grass was, they took me out and showed me, that's grass, you know. And it took me about a year. And then they put me into a friend's school in Saffron Walden, which was really away. But by this time I was 12, and my contemporaries were learning a second language. And it was desperate for me to learn French when I hardly speak English. And, you know, I'd have to conjugate verbs, and I couldn't do it, you know. And the teacher in desperation said, well, do it in Hungarian. So I'd put it on the board, conjugate it in Hungarian, and then he'd be pleased because he recognized the Latin, you know, he went off on it. I was left off the hook. So I was there only a year only a term, because they had an infantile paralysis broke out and one of the children died. And my parents whipped me out, you know, didn't want me to get it, my sort of still dilapidated state. And I then went to a school, which was an extraordinary school. It was a progressively co-educational school, and my brothers were already there in Kent, called Longdean School, which had its foundations actually in Scotland, I discovered, in a school called Kilquanity. somewhere in Ayrshire. And it was run, they put me there because it was run on, well, it was very free. It had a farm attached. Education wasn't a high priority, but, you know, the arts and farming and, you know, it was to build us up. And so I was there till I was 16 and managed to fail most of my O-levels. But undaunted, I went to another school and started on my A-levels.
So were you? Was that residential as well?
Yes, yes, right. It was in Kent, yes. It was in Chiddingston, near Tunbridge Wells, in a castle, Chiddingston Castle, right. No pseudo-castle. And it was a wonderful place, really. And the friends I made there, school children, still have, you know. So it was the beginning of proper education. Mm-hmm. From there, at 16, I went to Welwyn Garden City, to a proper school where they taught you lessons. And concentrated on the academic side. So I was there for a couple of years. And then...
And then you went to university.
Well, they... Fortunately... Well, I was allowed to give up things like maths. And you needed maths. I didn't know the difference between arts and sciences. So, you know, I had to do a lot of work during the holidays. And when I went to the school in Welwyn Garden City... I had to take up science and maths, you know, 16 from scratch, because, you know, I was allowed to give it up. That wasn't so important. Mm-hmm. In Longdean School, the teachers, only the headmaster had a degree. They were refugees and, you know.
Were they Jewish refugees or was it a mixture of refugees?
The teachers. Mm-hmm. Well, one was a Sri Lankan.
Right.
He wasn't Jewish, but I think I only learned recently that the nurse was Jewish, mm-hmm. and the German teacher was half and half.
And the children who were there, were they
the similar children to were mostly, well, delinquents sent by London County Council because of the free atmosphere. But the trouble is that the balance was tipped in favor of them, you know, because they paid for it. See, right. My parents paid for us. But they had too many of these children, so the school really went. In fact, but in 1952, it went into disillusion because some of the staff were a little delinquent. But it was a sort of free and happy place. We got plenty to eat and the arts.
And I think compared with what you'd gone through...
Yeah, it was... this is why my parents... Uh-huh. Put us there, and, you know, I think you could be a vegetarian there. You know, it was all health, and mm-hmm. it was avant-garde. It mm-hmm. was, you know.
And you could be a child.
Pardon?
You could be a child.
Yes, yes. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we had a wonderful time there. We built a lorry with the biology teacher, and on this lorry we went to Italy and Spain, and we made costumes out of sackcloth and dyed it and acted on Shakespeare plays. You know, we had mm-hmm. real fun. But academic education wasn't too seriously taken.
But on the other hand, it's a holistic view of
education.
It was.
Mm-hmm. I never regretted it. It was mm-hmm. wonderful.
And so where did you study?
Well, I went to this proper school mm-hmm. in Welwyn Garden City and did 2 years there, managed to get advanced German and biology, I think. I had to do maths, you know, from scratch and chemistry. And eventually I got into University College London. They did a course called intermediate, so you could mm-hmm. make up. So I did zoology, botany, psychology, and chemistry there. So that brought me more or less on a level with others. Not quite, but more or less. And then I didn't get a place there for a degree, but I got into Chelsea College of Science and Technology, and I did my degrees there. And I did, after that, I did my PhD there as well.
Parents must have been so proud, you know, that you've...
I don't know. I think I was a disappointment to my father. At least that's how he made out, because he wanted me to get married and have six children. That would have been like a Victorian father. So when he got grandchildren, I said, well, you know, now you've got a grandchild. But he said, no, it's not the same as from a girl. But he never let on to me. But he must have been, because to other people, you know, other people would come and say, your father is, you know, pleased. But he would never let on to me.
Mm-hmm. And so did your parents live to a long age, or?
My father, well, when I what happened then? I did my degree. I went out, came up to Glasgow, and I got a job as a very well-known professor's assistant, research assistant in Edinburgh. So I spent 3 years with him, and then I got an assistant lectureship in the university zoology department. And then the policy was you couldn't stay on after that. You had to move on. And I got invited to Glasgow University. Imagine. And now people are clamoring for jobs. Then you were invited to apply. So I was very lucky. I was invited by the professor of zoology, and I got the job. And I'm still in the department 40-something years after. But in 1975, I decided I need a break from Glasgow. And I'd met someone at a conference and had invited me to go to Australia. So being a zoologist, I thought, well, you know, I must take my chance, go see the world. So I went out there for a year. And while I was there, my father passed away in 75. And my mother, I was offered a job, you know, out there, but I thought, well, I've been separated from my family once in my lifetime. It's too far away. Mm-hmm. So although everything was honky-dory, I decided to come back. And, you know, because my mother was still alive, and she lived to be 83, and she lived till, I think it was 1990. So that's what happened.
And so you have twin brothers and a twin brother and sister.
Yep.
And so did you see that? Are some in America?
And yes, funnily enough, the Hungarians became British, and the British went out to America and eventually became Americans, you know, as though they were running away from us. So it's only in the last 10 years I've really got to know my sister, because now I go out there the last few years to visit my aunt, who's now 100.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I spend a couple of weeks with my sister, who's a timeshare in Mexico. And this year, I came back via New York, where I've got my brother and his extended family. So, you know, we're still scattered, but we keep...
Mm-hmm. And are you the only person who's gone into academia?
Yes.
What speciality did you...
Pardon?
Did you have a speciality?
Yes, I took a... I specialised in entomology,
insects.
Did my PhD on insect embryology. Spent 3 years studying an egg which was 1.5 millimetres long.
As you do.
As you do. And then when I went to Australia, I thought, well, Australia's famous for marsupials. Mm-hmm. So I actually changed to marsupials. I set up the first colony of marsupials in Glasgow University. And, you know, we published quite a bit on it.
So do you work with the vet school?
No. I taught vets, but no.
Uh-huh.
Pure developmental biology became my field. First in insects and then in mice and marsupials, reproductive biology and embryology.
So we usually finish, Suzanne, by asking about reflections, and we'd like to finish with positive as well. So when you look back, because you've obviously had a wonderful, I think, academic career, what would you say is the highlights?
Of my academic career?
And your life in general.
Well, I think my early life taught me values. It taught me how to appreciate things. I take nothing for granted. I don't waste resources. Mm-hmm. I recycle everything. And, you know, I appreciate everything that comes my way. It's made me positive, I think. And it's made me very grateful to the good Lord, in whom I believe, mm-hmm. that, you know, I owe my miraculous survival, and that of my family. I mean, it really is miraculous that we all separately, under such circumstances, so I very much believe in providence, in the goodness of God. And I try to do my best, you know, to spread good things around and to be positive.
I think you do, because you do also a lot of voluntary work as well. So despite the fact of retiring, you seem to be busier now.
Oh, yes. I just wish I had more energy, because, you know, I get tired sometimes, mm-hmm. and I can't work till 2 in the morning as I used to do before. But, you know, you have to know your limitations, mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, just be grateful for what you have, because we have so much, and we know now how badly off people are in other parts of the world, mm-hmm. and I'm very happy with my own life. My only sorrow is that everybody isn't in the same happy position, that they're still prejudiced and still all these negative things and wars. I just pray for peace every day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a real privilege. Thank you very much.